And thank you so much for joining us for our first show. It's Friday night, hoping each week we can learn a little bit about the key issues together and have some fun along the way. So let's begin that with Gavin Newsom. He's the former San Francisco mayor, current lieutenant governor, and frontrunner to be the next governor of the state of California. Thank you for being our first guest on our first show.
Honored to be here. Thanks for having me.
All right, let's talk about one of the big issues right now, which is that of sanctuary cities and sanctuary state. We've seen so much blowback to the state sanctuary state bill that's been before. We've seen all these town halls. We've seen cities trying to opt out. Is there any part of you that has thought, maybe it's time to rethink this? Maybe the state has gone too far.
I don't think so. I think most people haven't read it. Most people are asserting their opposition. I'm not sure I've actually spent the time actually considering what it does and what it doesn't. You know, Rudy Giuliani is getting a lot of attention this last week. Rudy Giuliani was a principal proponent of sanctuary policy when he was mayor of New York. I hope you can advise the president on the principles behind sanctuary policy, which is about public safety. It's about building trust. It's about community policing. This state has had cities, large and small, traditionally conservative, not just liberal cities that have embraced the principles of sanctuary policy. We've seen an increase in immigration in the last few decades, and crime has actually dropped. So I think there's been a lot of misagogue on this, a lot of politicking around this issue, and I think the governor did the right thing supporting SB 54.
So the president says that there's a revolution going on in California against this. Yeah. If you were governor of California and you were in a room with President Trump talking with him, what's the first thing you say to him? How does that conversation go?
Well, I'd ask him what specific components of the legislation he's concerned about. What specific concerns does he have? And, you know, with respect, I can't imagine for the life of me he spent 5 seconds indulging and actually understanding. It was crystal clear when Jeff Sessions was here that he didn't read the legislation. That's why the governor, forgive me, but asserted that he lied about aspects of the sanctuary policy.
Another big issue is that of homelessness. We've seen an extraordinary growth, especially in L.A., some 66% in the last 6 years.
Yeah.
Democrats run the city. They run the state.
Yep.
What are Democrats doing wrong when it comes to homelessness?
Well, we own it. We own poverty as well. We're the richest and poorest state. You can't sugarcoat that, and I think we have to accept that responsibility, that accountability to do more and do better. The issue of homelessness is, you know, was front and center in terms of my history and the work we did in San Francisco. We got 12,000 people off the streets, reduced our street population by 40%, but there is no having made it. As soon as you house dozens of people, hundreds of people, thousands of people, more people arrive. We have a quarter of the nation's homelessness. By some estimates, 134,000 people living on the streets and sidewalks. L.A., it's manifested quite acutely.
So what do you do?
Specifically, we need a governor that's active in this space. We haven't been focused on it with intentionality. We've actually laid out a detailed strategy around homelessness. It's the reason I ran for mayor. It was the reason I think I got reelected for mayor. It's the reason I have a lot of critics when I was mayor as well. There's nothing easy about this. SSI advocacy, a framework around housing and supportive services. Shelters solve sleep. Housing and supportive services solve homelessness. A focus on brain health and not just physical health needs. Intersectionality around issues and making sure that we move forward in a more collaborative way by focusing on regionalizing solutions and not just expecting that cities themselves can solve the problem without the support of the state of California.
Now to the issue of leadership and debates. This week you're going to have a debate. Some of your critics have criticized you for not showing up to the last few governor's debates. And yesterday we were at an event with Antonio Villaraigosa's supporters of African American group. Danny Bakewell Jr. said that you're not showing up to that community. Take a listen to what he had to say.
We've never even seen Gavin Newsom down here in this community. That's one very good reason. But we have reliance on Antonio Villaraigosa. We have history with Antonio Villaraigosa. We have results with Antonio Villaraigosa.
So what's your response?
Well, unfortunately, the individual was simply unaware of the three events I've had just in the last few weeks, the town hall I just had in South L.A., the number of churches I've been visiting on weekends in South L.A., and met with, in fact, dozens of faith-based leaders just last week in South L.A., and actually have a town hall next week in South L.A. So with all due respect, that's a lot of politicking, but it's unfortunate that that was asserted and it's being replayed, but that's politics. I'm very proud, by the way, of the support I've received in the African-American community. And in contrast to Mr. Villaraigosa, who does not support bail reform, who's been a principal proponent of check cashing and payday lenders, we have a strong contrast in terms of our approach to dealing with, I think, some of the real challenges in the community.
Let's talk about your approach more in general, because you've been ahead of the game on a lot of things like gay marriage, on marijuana, on gun control. Jerry Brown has really been a backstop, though, against, in some ways, Democratic overreach, or some people would say that when he sees the Democrats spending too much money or maybe going too hard to the left. Does that change with you in there? I mean, is there anything specifically you think the Democrats have gone too far on?
No, I think, look, I think Governor Brown's done a remarkable job of proving you don't need to be profligate to be progressive. He's balanced budgets. We're going to have a 13-plus rainy day, billion-dollar rainy day reserve. We went from 12.4% unemployment to 4.3%, yeah. And we've had a remarkable recovery in the state, and I think that needs to be maintained. I'm as concerned as you are, or as I imagine anyone watching, that we go back to our old profligate ways. That said, look, I governed a city during a very difficult time. I've been accountable, responsible as the chief executive officer. It's one thing to sit on the sidelines. It's another to be there, making sure you balance those budgets, and I'll maintain that status as governor.
All right, it's our first show. We're trying something new. We've got two sets of cards, one called the policy issue and one called the personal issue. We're starting with policy issues, things like climate change, water, education. We want you to pick one and read it out.
Randomly.
These are issues that don't get enough attention. So what do we got there?
Education. Does California have too many or not enough charter schools, and why? I believe in charter schools. I've supported high-quality nonprofit charter schools, but I believe in accountability with taxpayers' dollars. I would support a transparency bill, and I'll continue to support high-quality nonprofit charters. I do not support for-profit charters, and I think the biggest issue in public education right now is the fact that we cannot recruit and retain high-quality public educators. That will be a top priority for me.
Okay, now let's do something a little fun. This is called the personal issue. This is fun questions. We got 30 seconds we're going to put on the clock. The challenge is to get as many of these as you can. So you're the first one up, but we got to set the standard, right, for the other governor candidates, okay? So try not to pass on them. Here we go. We ready for our 30 seconds? Let's begin this in 3, 2, 1, go. Favorite TV show?
Oh, geez, I can't skip. Okay. I don't watch TV.
Favorite sports team?
Oh, San Francisco Giants. Forgive me, all the LA Dodger fans.
Favorite athlete?
You know what? Steph Curry. It's a no-brainer.
Sushi or steak?
Sushi.
Favorite fictional character?
Oh, my gosh. I can't skip.
Favorite superhero?
I skip.
Favorite band or musician?
I'm a big, you know, it's strange. I'm going to say train. That surprises folks.
Wow. Favorite quote or motto?
The biggest risk in life is not that we aim too high and miss it, so we aim too low and reach it. Michelangelo.
All right. Nicely done. Thank you very much, Lieutenant Governor. Again.
Thank you. I'm hoping I'm not Darth Vader in this scenario.
Exactly. Well, let's talk for a moment about your New York Times op-ed, which just came out today. Let's put it up on your screen. And it says, Democrats don't take the bait on impeachment. What's your main point?
Well, my main point is, ironically, Donald Trump is out there talking about impeachment to his base and trying to suggest Democrats are not interested in governing. They're just interested in getting rid of me. That's a trap I think he would like Democrats to fall in. I tried an impeachment case in the Senate. I have some understanding of the very high bar to meet impeachment. And the investigation hasn't even finished. We don't know what Bob Mueller has to report yet. So I think we should let the investigations run their course. And Democrats would be wise to be campaigning on what they're going to do to deliver for their constituents on the economy and jobs, on health care, and things that really affect their immediate lives.
So to local Democrats like Brad Sherman, Maxine Waters, and others who are pushing impeachment hard, you're saying stop it?
I'm saying that for us to be advocating for impeachment before we even know what the full body of evidence is, and I've seen more of it than most of my colleagues, let's wait. This is a serious undertaking, and I think if the case is there later, if the evidence comes back from Bob Mueller and it warrants that step, it will be harder, not easier, if we've given the impression to a large part of the country that this is the end we wanted all along.
You know, some folks have already started talking about impeachment when it comes to this Stormy Daniels thing and potential campaign finance allegations there. Rudy Giuliani this week confirmed that President Trump reimbursed Michael Cohen for the hush money payment to Stormy Daniels. What do you make of that, and what does that do to the case?
The reality is they can't get their story straight because they're focused on telling a story. The truth matters very little. And, you know, either way, there's serious consequences. But what I think they've realized post-Giuliani is if the president did pay back Michael Cohen, if he was part of this, then he's involved in the violation of campaign finance law potentially. So I think they're having some second thoughts about this new legal strategy.
So you are the ranking member on the House Intelligence Committee. If Democrats took over the House in November, you'd become the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee. Right now, the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee says there was no collusion and no obstruction. You say you've seen evidence of both of those. If you become chairman, you have subpoena power, you have the gavel. What does that mean? What does that look like?
Well, the first thing that we would do is we would release all the transcripts of the interviews that we've done so far. The Republicans committed to doing this, but I knew that they wouldn't fall through because those transcripts both reveal evidence of collusion and obstruction of justice, but they also reveal the degree to which Republican colleagues on the Intelligence Committee were never serious about the investigation, ignored plain evidence of collusion, wouldn't allow us to bring in key witnesses. So that's the first step. And after that, I think we look at what has Bob Mueller done, what is the state of the investigation thus far, and what work remains to be done.
So for order that to happen, then Democrats need to take over. A lot of your colleagues feel that Nancy Pelosi is a political liability. Several of your colleagues have said they will not vote for her if the Democrats win the House. You have said that you would, that she should be Speaker. But why don't you think that she's a political liability?
Well, there's just an article in the Washington Post today about how the Republicans have tried to vilify Nancy Pelosi, and it largely hasn't worked. In fact, in the race in Western Pennsylvania, they spent millions of dollars with anti-Nancy Pelosi ads, and it didn't work. They still lost in a district that Trump won by 20 points. So I think it's a losing strategy. What's more, I think she's the best strategist our party has and the best tactician. And dealing with this president, you want someone with that capability at the helm.
Okay. Well, we know how busy you are. You're here all the time, you're on TV all the time. And as we said, it is May the 4th, and who knew that you had a side job? We've uncovered our investigative team. Check that out right there. That is Congressman Luke Skywalker. What's that about?
Well, you know, I've been hiding out on this island for a long time, but I was discovered and I was drafted back into service.
Okay, and a lot of Republicans out there will think that you actually are Darth Vader.
Yes, I'm sure that's true. That is the world we
live
in.
Depends on what side you're on. Congressman, thanks so much for being here. We really appreciate it. Welcome back to The Issue Is. Joining us now is our debut panel. Darren Schnur teaches about politics at both UC Berkeley and USC. Reba Martin is a legal and political commentator and author of the new best-selling book, Make It Rain. I'm going to show you that. And there's the cover right there. And Joel Pollack is host of Breitbart News Tonight and SiriusXM and author of How Trump Won. There that is, looking very good. All right, and full disclosure, Dan was my professor at USC, and it's kind of surreal to have you here for the first show.
It's a little weird for me too, Alex.
Yeah, it's awesome. All right, so let's talk about the governor's race. That's the first issue. We just had Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom here. What do you think of him on the show, and what do you think of the state of the race right now?
Well, it's interesting watching Gavin Newsom on the show, Alex, because in the deep blue state of California, he is the deepest blue of the top tier candidates. And it was very clear in his discussion with you that he was not going to allow any room to emerge on his political left. Once he's made it through the primary, and we can talk in a moment about who the other candidate might be, then you'll almost certainly see him make a more aggressive outreach effort toward voters in the political center. But at this point, the deep blue candidate in deep blue California knows he's the front runner. He's not going to do anything to compromise that.
And Areva, we have the top two system, which we're kind of testing out this time, which means it could be two Republicans, two Democrats, a Democrat Republican. Antonio Villaraigosa making a strong play yesterday in the African American community locally. What did you make of that? And what do you make of where he's at right now?
Well, clearly, Antonio at this point seems to be in a race for second position. Clearly, as Dan said, Gavin Newsom is the front runner. What I thought about that press conference, though, with Danny Bakewell and those African-American leaders, there was Herb Wesson, there was Curran Price, there was, you know, a whole host of African-American leaders. But if you look at that photograph, who wasn't there? Maxine Waters wasn't there. Supervisor Mark Ridley Thomas wasn't there. Magic Johnson wasn't there. Some of the faith leaders in the African-American churches weren't there. Mm. So I think that's pretty telling about where the African-American community is in California, which is to say there's not a monolithic African-American vote. And Gavin made the point that there are substantial numbers of African-Americans who are supporting him. So I think there's no clear front runner in the black community as it relates to the governor's race.
Yeah, and Magic Johnson, of course, such a big supporter of Antonio when he ran for mayor.
Yes.
Joel Pollack, let's talk about the Republicans. They're having their convention this weekend. We've got John Cox, we've got Travis Allen, both trying to coalesce Republican support. Do you see one of them emerging, and do you think that a Republican can win this thing?
Well, what we know is that both of those gentlemen have passed Antonio Villaraigosa in at least one poll. There's a surge of enthusiasm right now on the Republican side with the revolt against the sanctuary state laws. Ever since Jeff Sessions came in and the Trump administration's filed that lawsuit, you've seen community after community in Orange County, San Diego County, now other counties, coming out and opposing those sanctuary state laws. That has energized conservatives and given them a reason to reengage. So we see both Cox and Allen doing very well in polls lately. It may be less important for the party to agree on which one of them is going to support than for both of them to continue the enthusiasm around the sanctuary state rebellion. And if they do, one of them can make that second slot.
Another big issue is the Trump investigation. We saw Rudy Giuliani coming out this week confirming some stuff, and then President Trump potentially taking it back. Areva, I know you got a strong take. What do you think's going on with the Trump legal team?
I think they're in total turmoil. I think the left hand doesn't know what the right hand is doing. As you just said, Giuliani had this media blitz where he revealed facts about the legal case that weren't revealed previously, and those facts contradict what President Trump and Michael Cohen have been saying for months about the Stormy Daniels case in particular. And I think he created more questions than he did answers, and he's given federal prosecutors a lot of other leads that they will be sure to follow up on.
Joel, you're an attorney. Do you see it the same way?
Well, I think a lot of those prosecutors already had some of those leads. We saw the seizure of Michael Cohen's documents, potentially compromising the attorney-client privilege that he had with Donald Trump. The story this week that NBC had to correct partially was that they had wiretapped Michael Cohen's phone. Turns out they weren't listening in, but they were monitoring. We don't know the truth. There's a lot out there that suggests the president's under extreme pressure, and what's concerning is that prosecution seems to have run out of bounds.
Can I just comment on the attorney-client privilege? One of the things that Giuliani said that was so, such a bombshell statement was that Michael Cohen did very little legal work for Donald Trump. So it's kind of ironic when we hear these statements about the attorney-client privilege when you have a lawyer not serving in his capacity as a lawyer.
Another big issue this week, Kanye West and his potential role with the Republican Party. We've seen the president's support among some African Americans actually go up in the wake of this. What do you make of Kanye's place in all this?
Well, Alex, the former basketball player Dennis Rodman once said, he said, the only bad press is an obituary. And what Donald Trump and Kanye West have in common, and I think one of the reasons they seem to hold each other in very high regard, is they've both decided very early in their careers that controversy is good for business, whether it's selling music or selling a candidacy. And while I'm sure if you really broke it down, Kanye West and Donald Trump would agree on very little.
Yeah.
That penchant for controversy really binds them and has them.
And Kanye has 5 albums coming out. Thank you guys so much for being here, but they are not done yet. We've got a thing called the bonus issue. The panel will be talking with us. It's an additional digital-only segment. Welcome to Bonus Issues. This is the time where we get to talk a little bit more in depth on the web. We're in the podcast form. We're everywhere. And we got a great panel, our debut panel. Dan Schnur is here. He's a professor at USC and UC Berkeley, and he's done about 8,000 jobs in politics over the years. Areva Martin is here as well. She's a political commentator and author, and the author of Make It Rain, which I think we have a full screen of that we want to show everybody. And we also have got Joel Pollack, who's the author of How Trump Won. And let's show everybody Areva's book then. There it is, right there, Make It Rain, looking good. Sorry I don't have Joel's book here. Look it up. It's a great buy on Amazon. Okay, so let's talk a little bit more about the governor's race. We had Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom here. What did you make of him, Areva?
Well, I thought he did a good job. One of the comments that he made that stuck with me is the comment about education. You ask him a question about education, and specifically as it related to charter schools. And there's been a lot of talk from all of the candidates about charter schools. And I want to see more talk about public schools, because the reality is minority kids, poor kids, most of them are going to end up getting their education in public schools. So what are we doing to shore up public schools? And that's a big issue. And, you know, we have a new superintendent for Los Angeles Unified School District, Austin Buettner, controversial superintendent, and a lot of people are concerned about what happens. I know Austin personally. I think he's a great guy. He doesn't come from an educational background. He does have a kid with special needs, which for me, as a parent of a special needs kid, I want to see what's going to happen with our public schools, particularly for African-American, Latino, minority kids, kids with special needs, and I want to see all of the candidates talk more about how we improve educational outcomes for marginalized students.
Joel, Antonio Villaraigosa is being supported by the Charter School Association. They got an $8.5 million cash infusion. Reed Hastings giving $7 million. Eli Broad giving $1.5 million. What do you think they want for that money? How does that impact the race?
I think they want to shake things up. I think that's why you've seen significant money come into other races. 4 years ago, we had the race for school superintendent in California that was very close, very contested because of outside money coming in. We had it here in the LA school district, and people want alternatives. I mean, charter schools are public schools, but they operate differently, and people are thirsty for that alternative because the normal public schools in many places are failing those minority kids, and it's minority parents actually who are the grassroots support for a lot of charter school initiatives.
As for the race as a whole, we see Gavin Newsom leading the pack, and then there's this race for second between Antonio Villaraigosa, John Chung, Travis Allen, and John Cox, who are all sort of within the margin of error, depending on the poll. Where do you see this going?
Well, it's impossible to predict a few weeks out who is going to finish second in a field that's so closely packed together. But to me, the most important variable in this race, Alex, particularly as it relates to Villaraigosa, is turnout among Latino and Latina voters. And not to put too fine a point on it, if the Hispanic American community turns out at levels that are normally associated with presidential elections, Villaraigosa is not only in the runoff, but it's a very good chance of being the next governor. Mm. If, on the other hand, the Hispanic American community turns out at levels more normally traditionally associated lower levels with midterm elections, then he's in a much more difficult position. So the two questions to ask are, number one, can Villaraigosa convince Latinos and Latinas to vote in larger numbers than they normally would? And if Antonio Villaraigosa cannot inspire that kind of turnout, can Donald Trump?
Yeah. Joel, what do you think?
I think it's fascinating now that for two successive elections, we've seen an attempt to get the Latino vote engaged and also the vote in Los Angeles to challenge the dominance of San Francisco Bay Area politicians. The fact is that people in the San Francisco Bay Area just vote more often mm-hmm. and in greater numbers than in Los Angeles, where we have very low turnouts. You would think going into this race with Villaraigosa running and Kevin DeLeon running on the Senate side that you'd have a huge push for Latino voters to come out and voters across Southern California. These are hometown candidates. But just as in the Senate race with Kamala Harris and Laura Sanchez, it was really fascinating to see how the LA contingent just didn't show up.
Yeah.
So is that going to change this year? We're not seeing it yet.
It's going to change because they're all going to watch The Issue Is and they're going to be informed.
But if they do, and I'm so sorry.
Yeah.
You asked Gavin Newsom about sanctuary cities.
Yeah.
And what Joel alluded to, if I understood your point correctly, is that that is an issue on which many Republican and many conservative voters have such strong feelings, it could motivate a significant increase in turnout. The question is, can it also motivate a turnout among supporters of sanctuary cities? Gavin Newsom knows that these are voters with whom Villaraigosa has a natural advantage.
Right.
I think that's why he was so quick to emphasize the issue in his conversation with you.
Yeah, the resistance to the resistance. Could that be even stronger mm-hmm. than what we see? All right, let's talk about another big issue this week, North Korea. It seems like the president making some progress there. Does the president deserve credit, and does the president deserve a Nobel Prize?
Yeah, I don't know about a Nobel Prize. He definitely deserves credit, you know, for all of the antics and all of the drama around the presidency. And we were talking about that. If we stripped away the Twitter feed, if we stripped away the lawsuits involving, you know, adult film stars and, you know, all of the things that have shackled this president, you know, would his approval ratings be higher? Would we be applauding him in a different way than we are? And I think this North Korea or the possibility of some kind of peace negotiation with North Korea gives us an opportunity to perhaps see Donald Trump in a different light. Now, it remains to be seen because, like everything that this president does, there's a lot of announcements, a lot of pronouncements, and not always the follow-up and the action. So I think it's a jury is still out, as lawyers like to say.
Yeah, to another lawyer.
I think the Twitter and the controversy and the unpredictability of Donald Trump is partly what led to this moment. You know, he was making tweets or statements like fire and fury and my button is bigger than your button, and some of that was a real commitment to a military option, but some of it was also funny. And I think that Kim Jong-un got the joke, and I think he realized there was a human connection there that he might have with Donald Trump. In the tweet where Donald Trump infamously called him short and fat, he also said, maybe we can be friends someday. So.
Well, Kim Jong-un, known for a sense of humor.
When he tells a joke, you better laugh.
Yeah.
Severe consequences if you don't.
So as the non-lawyer on the panel, the non-author, too, I think I need to write a book.
It's time, Dan.
Okay. We accept you into the club.
You're way behind.
That's really, thank you. Donald Trump, right now, deserves a fraction of a Nobel Peace Prize, because we are still in the very early stages of this discussion. Look, the point is absolutely right.
Yeah.
Trump, no lie, in a very unconventional way, provoked the North Koreans into engaging in a way that they had not in many years.
Sure.
The question is, now that they're at the table, can he close a deal that the last several U.S. presidents cannot? If he can do that in a verifiable way, then that deserves a Nobel Peace Prize, but that's the much harder end of the bargain.
And he'll need the president of China to help with that as well, as well as the head of South Korea. All right, well, we're 900 days away from the election in 2020, so it's time to talk about it, right? We got a new poll out today, and it showed, it was New Hampshire Democrats, it showed that Elizabeth Warren was the front runner ahead of Joe Biden and ahead of Bernie Sanders. There's the results right there. Clearly, polls the day before the presidential election were wrong, so let's look at the 900 days out. But with that being said, what do you make of the fight for 2020 on the Democratic side? We could have like 25 candidates, right?
Yeah, people forget that in the early stages of the 2016 presidential campaign, there were 17 Republican candidates. And so I think you're exactly right, Alex. You could very easily see 20-something, if not 30-something, Democratic candidates in the early stages of this race. Right now, it's primarily a contest for name recognition, but the one thing I'd add, and would defer to both of the others on the panel on this, is very clear that whoever the identity of the nominee is, the energy in the Democratic Party is with its base, and the most populist voices are those in control of the discussion right now.
I'm excited when I saw that poll, because, one, it says, you know, we may be headed towards having a female nominee for the party for the second time, as we did, you know, in 2016, and the number of African American candidates, potential presidential candidates, has quadrupled, at least. And so, to think about this crowded field and how many women and how many African American and potentially Latino candidates is really exciting, I think, for the Democratic Party.
And we also could have Eric Garcetti in that field. He's heading out there. Joel, what do you make of Eric Garcetti, the presidential candidate?
We've got him, we've got Kamala Harris, we've got a lot of California candidates who need to start spending more time in New Hampshire, I think, judging on that poll. I think Garcetti presents an alternative for a couple of reasons. He's got some weaknesses too, but the alternative he presents is he's an executive, he's got governing experience, he's not just showing up to vote. He also is on the more moderate side of the Democratic Party, although he's in touch with the left on cultural issues, so he bridges all that. The weak spot has to do with homelessness in Los Angeles, which isn't only his problem. It's a problem all across the nation. But that was something he made a top priority, and we're still waiting to see the improvement there.
Yeah, and the challenge, of course, would be those ads with Skid Row
and
homelessness.
To Dan's point about the base, I think it remains to be seen if a moderate like Eric Garcetti can make, you know, to the top of the heap in a primary where the base is, you know, going to be so far to the left.
Yeah. Okay, let's do a new segment that we have called The Personal Issue. We did it with like a 30-second thing, but I'm just going to shuffle these cards. I'm going to give each of you one. I haven't even looked at it. And you can give us an answer, and we'll learn something about you. Look at that. So what do you think? Read out the question, and tell us what it
says. I was going to say, don't I get to do favorite superhero like Gavin Newsom?
Well, what's your question?
Well, my favorite superhero is Hawkeye the Marksman, and I'm seeing Avengers this weekend, so don't tell me if he survives or not.
Okay,
please.
What's your question?
Favorite athlete.
Who is that?
Oh, my gosh. My favorite athlete is Kareem Abdul-Jabbar.
Oh, nice. Mm-hmm. Dancing with the Stars.
Well, some of us are old enough to remember when he played basketball.
Okay, there's that too. Okay. All right.
Favorite sports team, but I'm going to interpret this a little differently. I'm going to take a little liberty and license
like
with it.
Like a good lawyer.
I'm going to say Venus and Serena Williams.
Okay, that's a team. They played doubles a lot
Their
of times
team.
Together.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
I got the question that Gavin Newsom wouldn't answer, which is favorite TV show.
Yeah.
And my wife and I are watching Last Man on Earth, which I don't know if you've seen. It's just hilarious. It's literally about a guy who's the last person on Earth, and then he discovers there's one woman left, so they decide to get together.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden he realizes there's another woman.
Yeah.
And it's a fantastic comedy about dynamics in a relationship.
So. Interesting. Okay. And of course, a new favorite show is The Issue Is. So let's go around the table real quick. The next issue is. What is the next big issue of the week ahead?
Yeah, ironically enough, the other panelists have already covered it, Alex. The next big issue is education. And if I can just say quickly to weigh in on the points that they made, I am a big charter school supporter. And I'm a big charter school supporter not for white wealthy kids, because the kids in Brentwood don't need charter schools, but those who come from the most challenged communities are the ones who benefit from educational choice. If you end up with the Villaraigosa versus Newsom governor's race, that issue explodes.
It explodes. Areva,
I think the next big issue is this poll that's going to come out on African-American voters in the state of California. So we saw the press conference with Villaraigosa. We heard Gavin Newsom talking about his support amongst African-American voters. But a poll is being conducted as we speak that will come out in the next week or 10 days or so, a deep dive into the voting patterns of African-Americans in the state of California. And we'll know which of the candidates for governor really have the support of the black community in California.
And Joel?
In the next 10 days, you're going to see attention shift back to the Middle East because the United States is moving our embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. I'm actually going to be there for that, along with many American members of Congress and members of the administration. It's a very big event, a big moment in history, and it's going to be what people are talking about over the next couple of weeks.
Thank you guys very much. Let's put those books up just to remind everybody. So we got Areva's book right there, Make It Rain. And we've got Joel's book as well, How Trump Won. And the next time Dan Schneur is here, he's going to have a book.
Maybe the time after that.
Maybe a lot of
Thank you guys for being part of our first show. This was fun, right?
This is a lot of fun.
Thank great
you.
Time.
You
guys are all
to
awesome.
You.
And it's so fun to be here. And thank you so much for joining us for The Issue Is. Again, next week, we're going to have a special conversation about race with John Lewis and Karen Bass. We're going to have a Republican gubernatorial candidate John Cox is going to be here. Plus, we have a special panel with Seema Mehta of the LA Times, Howard Bragman, the publicist, and Tim Conway Jr. of KFI. Ding dong. Have a great week. We'll see you then.